Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. My name is Keith Pannell, and today we're going to be talking to a seismologist. They're the sort of people that go around looking at what happened during an earthquake and obviously using the information they gather from earthquakes with very sophisticated equipment to help predict when new earthquakes will occur. And, of course, I suppose that's one of the major reasons people are interested in seismology, the why and then the predictive power of when it's going to happen so we can take precaution. Our guest then is Professor Thorne Lay. He's from the University of California at Santa Cruz. And for those of you listening in El Paso, I must add that he's also a proud graduate of El Paso High. Go Tigers. So, Thorne, welcome to Science Studio.
Well, thank you very much, Keith. It's a pleasure to be here.
Before we get into seismology and the different types of earthquakes, and there are many, which I didn't really know much about until I heard you talk one time, tell us about how did you get into this game in the first place? When you were in El Paso High, what was your vision? You wanted to do seismology or you wanted something totally different? And what turned you from one thing to another?
When I was in El Paso High, I don't think I even knew the word seismology or had any inkling that I would end up doing this as a career. I was a typical high school student with all the focus on high school activities and not much beyond. I did end up going away, leaving town to go to university. I went to the University of Rochester in New York. And at that time, I majored in mechanical engineering and geology in a dual degree. They called it geomechanics. And that gave me kind of quantitative training in mathematics and physics, as well as understanding geology, that were really good preparation for going into seismology, as it turned out. Though even then, I didn't know I wanted to do it.
No, but you've jumped already. I mean, you were in El Paso High, and then you go away and study geomechanics. I mean, that's just not your normal decision-making process. Was there something before that that suddenly gave you a window of opportunity, or what?
Well, it was perhaps some influence from my father, who had been a geologist with an oil company in the 50s, and he was working with the State Geological Survey in Wyoming when I was born. I was born in Casper, Wyoming. He was doing mapping for the geology program. But it turned out that at that time, geology was going through one of its up and down cycles. It was going into a down cycle. So he started going to law school, and we moved to Dallas. I actually lived in Garland. He went to SMU Law School, got his JD to become an attorney, and he moved out here to El Paso. So I came to El Paso and started the third grade. So we got here in 1964. So I had 10 years here all the way through high school. So I had a little bit of background exposure to geology, even though he wasn't doing it anymore.
Did your parents take you out into the field? I mean, did your father show you geology?
We used to throw the kids in the back of a big station wagon and drive to all the national parks, and he could explain the geology. And that was interesting. It added to our understanding.
Absolutely.
And, you kind of enjoy that, especially living in the Southwest, where geology is so visible and accessible. But I didn't have an inkling to go into geology. I had gone on a few UTEP geology field trips because my father knew the chairman of the geology department here. And so I got to go on some excursions and see a little bit of what geologists do, which is very different than what I do as a seismologist. So it's still – I don't think
kickers.
It was not a linear path nor one that I woke up every morning saying I want to pursue this area.
Right.
And that was true when I went to the university as well.
Okay, so let's jump right ahead. Then you went to graduate school, and now you're a professor at the University of California in Santa Cruz. Let's start with just a definition. Seismology, what does that mean?
Well, seismology is a bit broader than just the study of earthquakes. That's certainly a significant part. Now, seismology is the study of elastic waves, seismic waves, or P waves or S waves that travel through solid materials. And seismology has many applications. When we are able to record the seismic waves, they produce vibrations that we can feel very far away. And they transmit through the medium, the earth or any other body, as waves do, which are deformations that transmit through the body without changing shape. So you can relate what you see far away to what happened at the source. So by recording with seismometers, which are instruments that record ground shaking as a function of time at a particular position, we can take the signals that we record correct for how they propagate through the Earth and get back to the source that generated them. That could be an explosion, could be a landslide, or it could be a natural earthquake occurring within the interior of the Earth. And because we have good physics for taking the signals from far away back to the source, we're able to then study what happened at the source, how a fault ruptured, which is a break of a surface between rock masses that slide relative to one another, so we can study earthquakes. Or we can set off an explosion, look at the waves that go down, bounce off of layers inside the Earth, and determine the structure at depth, and that's how we find oil.
I was going to say, I mean, that's a very applied type of seismology, that you're looking for a particular deposit in this particular case.
That's right. And so seismology is most familiar in Texas because it's the primary tool used to explore the subsurface before they do very expensive drilling to try and find oil or water resources. I apply that type of approach all the way down to the center of the Earth using larger explosions or natural earthquakes that we can study the inner core of the Earth.
So all the way to the center of the Earth. So let me pose the question. I mean, I think I know the answer, but let's see if I do. You have an earthquake in place A, and you're over here in place B. And let's, for the moment, say that place A and B are diametrically opposed on the Earth. So the traditional England, Australia, down under.
Okay.
Right now, there's two ways that these propagated waves can come. One is around the surface, mm-hmm. and then the other, presumably, through the middle.
Right, through the middle.
Now, what are the differences between those two waveforms?
Well, it's
And
all,
is it true?
There are any source that would release energy in the rock will produce two types of waves, P waves and S waves.
And what do P and S mean?
P is primary, S is secondary. And the primary wave travels faster. It's the first one you observe. And the secondary wave comes in with a slower or later arrival time because it travels slower. So it's pretty simple. And these waves are expanding in all directions away from wherever the release of energy has occurred. And they transmit through the medium with a velocity that depends on the material properties of the rock or the medium that's transmitting through. So that allows the disturbance to go straight through the Earth as a P wave that could be seen on the opposite point on the Earth's surface after about 20 minutes. It takes about 20 minutes for the wave to go through. And really the P wave you can think of as sound wave. So the P energy is sound coming out from the source, but it's sound going through rock. So it takes that long for the sound to get through. Then what we have are seismometers, which are, you can think of them like stethoscopes put on the surface of the Earth that are just listening to the interior. And if there's a pinging release of energy and the wave spreads through, you can hear those waves arrive at different positions on our seismographs or seismoscopes. And that allows us to locate where the earthquake was, when it occurred, and then characteristics of it.
So the implication there is the fact that it's just not one seismology study like, say, at the University of Texas, but there's a whole network of these which are all connected together so that you can then really get very precise information as to where the source, the origin is.
That's correct. There are thousands of instruments deployed around the Earth's surface. Each one is operating 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, sitting there just recording the motion at that site. If there's a release of earthquake, the waves will spread out from it and they'll pass by these sensors and they produce shaking that gives us a signal that we can then analyze. And at present, about 1,200 stations around the world are transmitted in real time to data collection centers. So we can sit on our computer in my office and get the data as soon as it's recorded at different places around the world and begin analyzing right away the ground shaking that's produced to determine where and when and what type of event has occurred.
Is that available for the general population? Is
yes,
there a website
absolutely.
That I could sit in my office and think I'm doing what Thorne Lay does?
Yes, absolutely.
Waiting for an earthquake somewhere.
It's one of the great things about seismology. Intrinsically, the waves go everywhere in the Earth. And from the very dawn of the efforts to deploy seismic instruments around the world, which began in the late 1800s, really established the first networks by 1900, recognize those had to be in different countries all over. And countries, even hostile to one another, would allow the deployment of seismic instruments and the sharing of the data from it because they were very dependent on getting data from other countries. You cannot just study earthquakes that might affect your populations just with the stations in your country. So from early on, there was a kind of attitude of open access and sharing of data, which is now – leads to the present day situation where you can immediately get this, you know, over 1,000 records from many different countries. There's about 80 countries that would be providing data, and there's open access to it. So yes, it is available to individuals. And when I retire, I will be able to keep working. I don't have to be at a university or anything.
No, but you won't get paid. But during the Cold War, I mean, you know, I guess that was the 50s, the 60s maybe. Was there a change in the attitude? I mean, for example, the Soviets, did they all of a sudden say, wait a minute, we don't want to give access to that information, although they must have known they'd be available anyway. But was there a retrenchment of that openness?
Well, the political situation actually created the field of seismology as the modern global discipline that it is. It was from international efforts to monitor nuclear testing that many of the first kind of global stations, the upgraded global stations in the 1960s, were deployed. If you look at the station configuration, we're in about 60 or 70 countries. They sort of surrounded the Soviet Union. Well, and they were funded through the Department of Defense, and they put out instruments that were then openly available to university researchers. But the primary funding of that activity was to collect data relevant to monitoring what the Soviets were doing. And it was prompted by the agreement, the limited test ban treaty that had been signed by Kennedy and Khrushchev, which stopped atmospheric testing, which you don't need seismology to monitor. You need satellites and, right, and atmospheric sensors. But it had forced all testing to go underground. And underground explosions can only be effectively monitored if you're listening with all your stethoscopes to hear this, right, little blip go off in the earth. And that is a kind of the primary way that the field got the funding to become a truly international science.
It's interesting how you said that the seismology instruments were sort of, from the Soviet point of view, they were surrounded by these. But that just tells you a bit about the psyche. I go to Russia quite a bit. And in fact, they say the same. Look, we're surrounded by enemies. And back to the Cold War time, not so much today. And so it's kind of interesting to hear from your point of view, understanding that Soviet Union was surrounded by seismology, and yet they think that they were surrounded by potential enemies.
Well, indeed. And the big breakthroughs with the Soviet Union were coming as it was actually starting to go into decline, when they allowed sharing of data from inside their country, and we allowed them to come and monitor some of our nuclear explosions, and that kind of opened up the present-day situation. We're now amongst the stations that are openly available. They're included many that are within the Soviet Union, so that they're – or within Russia now.
Right.
And that is a real transition. But, of course, the primary concern for monitoring of nuclear testing, which is one of the mainstays of seismology, is to monitor the proliferation of nuclear testing. So areas like North Korea, the nuclear tests that they've been conducting since 2006 have been monitored cooperatively by the Russians, the Chinese, the Americans, because everybody
wants to know
what's happening.
Right. This is all very interesting, and we'll come back in one moment. You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. I'm here with Professor Thorne Lay, University of California, Santa Cruz. We'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog.
And I'm Dr. David Niesel. Norbert and I both watched a popular movie a few decades ago called The Fly.
Yeah, the scientist does an experiment where he ends up half human, half fly. It was creepy, but silly too. Except it's not so silly anymore. Several labs across the country are now creating human hybrids.
The term is used loosely, but at MIT, for example, they're introducing human genes into mice to see the impact on the mouse brain function.
A Franken-mouse? Well, not quite, but neuroscientists have introduced the human FOXP2 gene into mice. Since the gene is associated with language and speech development, did it enhance mouse brains?
To find out, they placed these engineered mice in a maze with normal mice. Both groups had to find chocolate using either visual or tactile clues, such as changes in the floor texture.
The hybrid mice got there faster. In fact, they were a third faster. But what's interesting is when either visual or tactile clues were removed, the hybrid mice did no better. They were faster only when they could integrate both forms of information, just like we do.
Humans learn tactile information unconsciously, while we absorb visual clues using declarative learning. Being able to switch between the two memories could explain why the hybrid mice did better and how it's important to human speech development.
For example, when babies learn to speak, they're using declarative learning by mimicking sounds, just as the mice learned the visual cues. When babies transition and speak automatically, that's unconscious learning, just as the hybrid mice did when they felt the floor texture change.
These experiments give us unique insights into human physiology, which may lead to new therapies. As for the Frankenmouse, you sci-fi fans will have to wait.
We are Drs. David Niesel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Professor Thorne Lay, University of California in Santa Cruz. And we're talking about seismology and this network, international network of seismographs around the world. Now, in science, I mean, in my own case, I'm a chemist, but I go and visit other laboratories and they have different techniques than I have, and so I can learn by international travel. It seems to me that in your game, since you're getting the data straight away, is there much to be learned by going and visiting a university in, say, Vladivostok to see how they do their seismology? Or is that useful and does it get done and do you do it?
Well, that is very useful, of course, because every research group has developed independent procedures and computer codes to process data. There's innovative approaches are developed constantly. So we have international meetings where everybody comes and presents those, but it's also very helpful to go and visit different countries and talk with them, often bringing the techniques that we have developed to help explain to them, share our software. And this happens very extensively. There's wide dissemination of the research products in seismology because they are so valuable to many countries that are monitoring earthquakes and dealing with earthquake hazards. So they want to have the best understanding of how to process the data. And the developed nations that have been doing a lot of research in this area can share that and do share that with the developing nations.
So then let's talk about earthquakes. I mean, we talked about the seismology a little. Are there many types and differences between one earthquake and another? Do you subdivide and say that's a number 5 earthquake and here's a number 7, different types of earthquake?
Well, earthquakes intrinsically are sudden shearing motions within rock, and it's two rock masses that have a surface contact between them.
And these are usually the plates that one talks about, the tectonic
plates. It could be on the scale
plates.
It could be on the local scale of fractures in fracking to get oil out of the ground. What happens is you have rock masses that slide relative to one another, and they're sliding on a surface contact. Initially, that surface has friction that keeps it from sliding, and you have to build up enough strain or deformation surrounding rock to overcome friction. And when that happens, if it's going to make an earthquake, it happens very quickly. The friction initiates a crack. That crack spreads very quickly. That's the area that is sliding on that surface, and it releases all the accumulated energy. Then it sticks again, and friction holds it up. So you have sticking and slipping and sticking and slipping. That is the primary mechanism that causes repeated earthquake occurrence on fault. The Earth's surface, broken up into big chunks of rock or plates, they're moving relative to one another. And on their boundaries, they're sticking and slipping, producing earthquakes concentrated on the boundaries of the big plates of the Earth. And that process is going on for millions of years, so the earthquakes are happening every 100 to a few hundred years to keep up with the overall motions of the plates, which are driven by thermal cooling of the planet.
That's the basic nature. They're going to go on forever and ever. There's never going to be a time where there's no earthquake because we're cooling all the time.
It will go on as long as the Earth's thermal engine has sufficient energy content to keep the plates moving. Eventually, plate tectonics will cease. It has stopped on Mars. It has stopped on the Moon. They don't have any kind of ongoing surface deformation analogous to what's happened on the Earth.
If you put a seismometer on Mars, there's nothing to listen to.
Well, you won't have plate tectonics like on the Earth. We're sending a seismometer to Mars in 2016. It should land. It's called the InSight mission, and it will be deployed on the Martian surface. They've only had a seismometer once with the Viking landing long ago, but it was on the landing unit and it wasn't well coupled to the Martian surface. Well, this is going to put the instrument on the Martian surface, and we're hoping to hear a Mars quake. There could be internal stresses
within a Mars quake. I love it.
That could be due to internal deformations. There's still volcanic activity. There's freezing of the surface of Mars. those could produce stresses that cause fractures to occur. We don't know, and we're hoping to find out the question or answer that question when the instruments get to Mars. But the Earth is very active, and it's doing this still extensively on the planet, and it will continue to do it for hundreds of millions of years into the future. So we're basically at this instant in time, we put out our instruments, we have this kind of global network of stethoscopes that are listening to the internal workings of the planet, and it's just going off all the time. So this allows us to look at earthquakes. But your question was, are there different types of earthquakes? Well, some of the faulting involves very tiny little fractures, and others are vastly bigger. So there's a huge range of scales in earthquakes. So what we do is we measure with seismic magnitudes how big the ground shaking is for different events. So you've probably heard of the Richter magnitude scale. The Richter magnitude scale, developed by Charles Richter, who was a seismologist at Caltech working in the 1930s, was take recordings from seismic shaking of the ground, so taking early seismic records and measuring the amplitude of that shaking and developing a relative size measure that was proportionate to the energy in the signals. And so a magnitude 4 earthquake produces ground shaking that's about an order of magnitude smaller than a magnitude 5. So it goes up about a factor 10, actually closer to a factor 15 for every increase in a magnitude unit. So a 5 is much bigger than a 4, and a 6 is much bigger than a 5.
What's the biggest Richter scale earthquake that we've recorded modernly?
Well, the Richter scale itself was designed with particular instruments, and we have a modern magnitude scale. It's called the moment magnitude scale, which supersedes that. And the largest moment magnitude, and moment is a measure of the total energy of the biggest earthquakes or of any earthquake, but allows you to capture the signal from the biggest earthquakes. And the largest has been the 9.5, and the 9.5 event was in 1960 in Chile.
That's a lot of energy.
It was an enormous amount. It involved a fault that ruptured 1,000 kilometers long or 600 miles long, and it was a couple hundred kilometers wide, maybe 120 miles wide.
That would be on the eastern side of the Andes.
It was on the west coast of South America,
right,
where South America is plate tectonics is moving South America to the west, and it's overriding a plate called the Nazca Plate, and it was the plate boundary between those two, with the Nazca Plate going down under South America where this giant rupture occurred. And it slipped as much as 20 meters, 60 feet in a couple of minutes. So it was a huge event. If you take the area that ruptured and superimpose it on a map of the United States, the area is equal to that of California, suddenly sliding 60 feet.
That's like a very high percentage of Europe.
Yeah, so it was a vast area and almost would reach across Texas. And it was, a huge amount of energy had been built up during the stuck part, the stick part.
I mean, given all this energy that we know is there, we're clever enough to know where the fault zones are, where things are likely to happen.
Right.
I mean, I know in El Paso we're on what they call the Rio Grande Rift, and so we get earthquakes, but they're around the 4. I mean, you don't feel them, at least I've never felt one. But over there on the California coast and all around the Ring of Fire down to Japan, etc., we know that they're going to happen. So because this is a very industrial area, you know, the west coast of America and then Japan, there must be an awful lot of work concentrating on that particular area.
Well, those are the major plate boundaries,
yes,
kind of around the Pacific plate, which is, you know, sliding relative to the North American plate, for example. And that produces the major earthquakes in California, which involve horizontal shearing. Primary fault is the San Andreas Fault. And yes, it goes from just east of Los Angeles up through the San Francisco Peninsula up to the north. So that is an area that we study because we know it's on a plate boundary. It will have big earthquakes in the future. It has had big earthquakes in the past.
Presumably, I mean, the people who live in California in particular would be very anxious to know when one is going to come. But that's not sort of on the close horizon, I think, in terms of research knowledge at the moment. But what we can do, presumably, and what is more important, is to prepare better societally for the earthquakes that are coming. I mean, is that a correct sort of status where we are today?
That's certainly true. But plate tectonics tells us where the very biggest earthquakes are likely to occur. There can be earthquakes away from the plate boundaries, and there are earthquakes. And they're a little bit more challenging to anticipate how frequently they will occur if we don't have a long record of them. But in places where we know earthquakes are going to occur, we don't have the ability to give a precise place and time and size prediction at this point. That may never be viable for all faults. It may be that a few areas will be able to have more predictive capability. But knowledge that big earthquakes will occur and the understanding from seismology of how strong the ground shaking is guides the development of building codes, for example, right. that say what level of shaking do you anticipate a particular building experience in its lifetime and how do you design the building to withstand that shaking, not catastrophically collapse. And that is the field of earthquake engineering. So they have made great advances in that and have performed very well. In the recent earthquake in Japan in 2011, it's a magnitude 9 earthquake. The shaking damage was very limited. The earthquake engineering in Japan is exceptional, and there was very modest amounts of shaking damage. Of course, there was damage, as you expect for such a huge earthquake, but it was very successful practice of earthquake engineering. In that case, though, there was another hazard, which was the generation of a large tsunami, because the faulting had occurred out under the ocean and pushed up a lot of water that then came on land in a tsunami wave. And that caused the great devastation. That's a little bit harder to build for. The Japanese had built tsunami protection walls that were typically 5 meters high off of some of their harbors. But unfortunately, the wave that came in was generated from this huge earthquake was as much as 15 meters at most of the central part of Japan, and as high as 40 meters in some places in northern Japan. Very difficult to build walls that big offshore, so you just can't afford to do it.
We just got a limited amount of time, and I think people would be really annoyed if I didn't come back to something that you mentioned, this whole business of hydraulic fracturing now. And it's clear, I think, to say that the hydraulic fracturing in Oklahoma and out so further east in Texas is creating small earthquakes.
Well, hydrofracking is explicitly fracturing rock by putting high-pressure fluids into the ground. You create little cracks and you prop them open by having sand grains in there to get gas out as you pump the fluid back out. That's a very micro earthquake.
Right.
So hydrofracking does that. Every once in a while, you'll produce a larger fracture than you expected. And they've produced up to magnitude 3.5 fracture by hydrofracking, by direct high-pressure injection of fluid. But hydrofracking is generally well-controlled around the drill hole. The problem for the industry has been that when you hydrofrack, then you pump the dirty water back out in order to get the gas out. What do you do with the dirty water? You need to clean it.
Well, that's a separate issue, though. I mean,
but that's what's causing the bigger earthquakes.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Now, what they do, rather than do a chemical filtration and cleanup analysis, which would be very expensive, is they take the dirty water and they pump it down into deeper holes. This is called deep injection. Deep injection is not intended to be pumped in and pumped out. It's a one-way trip. You're trying to contain and isolate dirty water, sequester it for long periods of time down below aquifers that humans use,
right.
And you do not want earthquakes. But the problem is that when they put the water in deep, 5 kilometers or deeper, that's where there's more stress down in the Earth's crust, and 99 times out of 100, no earthquakes occur. The water is just taken up into the open pore space of the deep rocks. But in some deep injection zones, as in Oklahoma, when they put the deep, dirty water down there, which they're hoping to contain there, it does turn out that there are faults down there that when they get wet, they suddenly can fail.
We've come to the end of our science studio, Thornley. It's been great to have you here. And I'd like to thank Norma Martinez for putting this together so it sounds as professional as it can be. And we'll be back next week with another science studio for you to listen to and enjoy. Bye-bye.